welcome back to another episode of It's Paranormal. It's your host, Adam Sane, and...
it's your co-host, Luke Reed.
All right, Luke, what you been doing, man?
Well, I went to the Wild Beaver and had a few drinks with Candy and Paige and watched a... I rode a mechanical bull and watched a drunk girl get flung into a table and knock the whole table and everyone sitting at the table down.
You really live the life, man.
This is fun.
Watching old women get thrown off mechanical bulls.
Young drunk women thrown off.
Wasn't bulls. There an old woman you were telling me about, like a Cajun woman
she,
or something?
She was at the it was just an old regular old lady just at the nail and tried to lean on a table and missed it and she knocked herself unconscious on the table.
Man, you're really seeing some awesome displays of humanity lately. Let me tell you.
Yeah, I enjoy it. That's what I live for.
So I understand that you have. You've delved into the area of horrible rap music.
Yeah.
Without getting too, obscene about the title, you can kind of describe the wonderful music that's out there for young teens today.
Well, I used to be a victim of hip-hop myself when I was younger. And, of course, I still listen to, like, some underground hip-hop and stuff to skate to. And,
sure.
You know. But, those lyrics actually have some substance to it. And I was talking to a younger kid at the skate park, and he tells me about this guy named Chief Keef. And I go look him up. And
it rhymes.
it rhymes, yes. And this whole, like, slow talk rap thing is taken off, and the lyrics are just really stupid. I mean, there's no substance to it whatsoever.
Did you describe it as Sesame Street with a beat?
Sesame Street with a beat behind it. Yeah, profane lyrics. difference. It's like Hooked on Phonics with a beat behind it.
Turn into more serious things. What did you think about our guest last time, Andrew Hoffman?
I'm remembering what he talked about. It's been a long time, man.
Only like 2 weeks ago, man.
That's a long time for me. Lots happened since then, dude.
That's because you ate that $5 pizza today.
What did he talk about?
Oh, man. Okay. Anyway. Well, we talked about like current events, talked about propaganda, eugenics.
Oh, yeah. I like that guy, man. He was cool.
Yeah.
He had some pretty good things to say, and we're pretty much on the same page about all that.
Yeah, he's got a lot of good points. Tonight, we're going to have on Adam Gilrightly. He's the author of many different books. His latest book is Happy Trails to High Weirdness, and another book that I've read by him, The Beast of Adam Gilrightly. And he talks about a lot of strange material. He calls himself a crackpot historian. And he talks about, writes about Charles Manson, about several other weird, just conspiracy theory things, UFOs. Also, another one that he wrote was one that found very interesting was one that he had done about the true story behind Altered States, which was where these guys were injecting ketamine and doing deprivation chamber experiments. And thought that was really interesting that was that's actually based on a true story. I've seen that movie so many times, but I never actually had ever known that.
In the movie, he was taking Mexican, like, shroom soup.
Yeah.
And then in his story, he's talking about ketamine.
Yeah, they were injecting ketamine. But what was interesting was that they said that they had, like, were having dreams of, or hallucinations where they were walking around thinking that they were proto-human. So that's where the whole basis for the Altered States comes in. But we're not going to bore you anymore. We're going to get to the interview, and we'll be right back on Conspiranormal. Hey, and we are back on Conspiranormal. It's your host, Adam Sane, of course.
Your co-host again, Luke Reed.
All right, well, tonight we have on the line... Adam Gilrightly. I'm a big fan of his books. And Adam, how you doing tonight?
Great. Thanks for having me on.
Hey, we're very privileged to have you on. Just for our audience that maybe don't know you, could you kind of tell everyone who you are, and we'll kind of go from there?
Well, I'm the kind of a renaissance man of the lunatic fringe. I've written half a dozen books. Most well-known is the Shadow Over Santa Susana on the Manson Family Saga, as well as my book, The Prankster and the Conspiracy, the book about Carrie Thornley, as well as my latest book, Happy Trails to High Weirdness. So there's about half a dozen books. I also had a podcast that kind of had a cult following. People still talk about it a bit. Untamed Dimensions, that went from 2006 to 2008. I did that for a couple of years. I've also make the convention conference scene. I spoke at UFO conferences, so I have an interest in the paranormal and conspiracies. I really started cut my teeth writing for zines back in the day in the early 90s. I'm also a musician and a filmmaker, gotten into that a little bit here in the last couple of years. So I'm kind of all over the map, have a couple of websites. I have a blog, which is Untamed Dimensions, where I post some oddities. I have a Devil Girl of the Month and a Crazy Bongo Broad of the Week and Kooky Christian album covers. So I have a lot of eclectic interests.
Oh, yes, that is for sure. Could you kind of describe your book, Happy Trails to High Weirdness? That's your latest.
Mm-hmm. The subtitle is A Conspiracy Theorist Tour Guide. And it's kind of my take on traveling across the country, visiting some of the historic, stranger sites connected to paranormal and ufology, like Roswell, for instance, or Giant Rock and the Integratron, and going to different conspiracy conferences and UFO conferences and writing kind of a behind-the-scenes take of a lot of those conferences, told in a freewheeling manner and kind of all Hunter S. Thompson in a sense. And also I recount a lot of some of the strange experiences I've had over the years, psychedelic UFO encounters and encounters with Go Rightly doppelgangers. So that, in a nutshell, is the book. It's Happy Trails to High Weirdness, A Conspiracy Theorist Tour Guide, available now from Amazon.com.
There's a little plug there, huh?
Yeah.
One of the parts that I found interesting, and I actually watched a documentary about this person shortly after I read that book, was a Mr. Jeff Turner and some mm-hmm. of his interesting ideas.
Indeed, interesting. I first caught wind of Jeff Turner, it's been a few years ago now, and of course I write about it in the book. I was part of a internet forum that dealt with, it was one of the Yahoo groups that dealt with Texas psychedelic music from the back in the day, you know, Rocky Erickson and the 13th Floor Elevators. And anyways, there was a fellow posting to that forum by the name of Douglas Hawes, who said he, in one of his posts, he said he had a contact who had information about Tuesday Weld being an Illuminati high priestess and how she really heavily influenced the 60s counterculture. And I read that and I go, wow, that's some mind-blowing stuff. I don't know if you guys are that familiar with Tuesday Weld. She was a 60s screen starlet.
I'm really not too familiar with her. Yeah. Not until like quite recently, really.
Yeah, no clue.
And it's kind of started a meme, I think.
Yeah.
So I contacted this fellow, Douglas Hawes, And we started a correspondence, and I said, yeah, this fellow, your source, whoever he is, has some interesting theories. I'd like to meet up with you guys. So I went and met up with them in Santa Cruz, and this mysterious source was Jeffrey Turner, who... And when I met the fellas back at that time, they told me about this documentary that was being made about Jeff and Jeff Turner, and they made it sound like it was exclusively about Jeff, but it was really the focus of the film was on Jeff and this other person that were big fans of the singer Tiffany. You could call them... stalkers almost, and
big fans is kind of an understatement.
and so that is what the film is about. I Think We're Alone Now, which is pretty damn interesting.
Yeah.
In the first cut of the film, I actually appeared for a few seconds, but I've seen the version that was released, and I got cut from it. But the scene I was in was when I first met Jeff Turner. We were in a coffee shop in Santa Cruz, and he was blowing my mind. So anyway, he has these theories. One of them, you know, that Tuesday Weld oversaw the 60s counterculture as head of the Illuminati and directed the actions of a lot of the major groups of the period, and behind the scenes she was dictating world events. In the 80s, mid to late 80s, came this singer Tiffany. So if you think of Tuesday Weld, and she's kind of a bad witch, she's involved with the Process Church of the Final Judgment, who are connected to the Manson family, at least according to Jeffrey Turner. Tuesday Weld was kind of a bad witch, brought psychedelics into the scene, and, you know... basically behind a lot of these MK Ultra and these things that were going on during that period. So if you think of Tuesday with kind of evil intent, Tiffany is a good witch, Jeff believes, and that she's came to battle the likes of Tuesday Weldon, that Tiffany, and this is the popular singer from the 80s, is the leader of something called the All Worlds Movement. The All Nations Movement, excuse me, and that she's trying to bring harmony into the world. She's also a Sufi master and a interdimensional time traveler. That's Tiffany. So Jeff Turner has all these things going on. You know, what's weird, when I first started writing about the Tuesday Weld stuff, I started hearing from other people independent of Jeff Turner, and they had weird stories about... Tuesday Weld, yes, she had been involved in some type of cult or another source. She had been a mind control victim. And then even recently, Ken Thomas of Steam Shovel Press was viewing a bunch of old Route 66 shows and saw a bunch of conspiratorial symbolism, and Tuesday Weld ended up showing up in one of those episodes, a very... odd episode that once again has a lot of this weird symbolism connected to it. So anyway, that's Jeff Turner, a very fascinating character. I mentioned earlier I'm involved in film production. I've been working with a Australian director by the name of Sam Fielder, and we're kind of doing a version of Happy Trails to High Weirdness. The film is called Parafornia, and one of the people we interview in the film is Jeff Turner.
Isn't he obsessed with Alyssa Milano now?
He is, but actually he got busted stalking her about a year or two ago. Originally he was talking up Alyssa Milano, but I think she rebuked him. Now she's on his evil list.
She's a Illuminati priestess.
Something, yeah. So he's she turned on him.
Well, one thing about him, he does have was it Asperger's syndrome?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. I interviewed those guys on my podcast too. You can go back.
Oh wow.
And listen to some of the archives, if you go to my blog, which is gorightly.wordpress.com, and go on the right side and look for audio archives, and you can get into it. And there was like a three-part series I did with Turner and Hawes called The Secret History of the Summer of Love. Some mind-blowing internet radio there.
I'd like to ask you, too, about another interesting person of the past, and Cary Thornley.
Yeah.
He has a very interesting path, and I believe that he was... he lived in Atlanta for a while. I used to live down there myself, and I think I may have actually have, I don't know if it was when he was still alive, but I may have actually have been in that bookstore that he used to work at. He kind of tell everybody about Cary Thornley and who he was and just kind of the interesting history there.
Yeah, he he spent a lot of time in Atlanta in the last couple decades he was there. Certainly the last decade he was kind of primarily there in little Five Points. And he lived in Acapella bookstore.
Yes.
In the back.
I'm familiar with it.
I actually have some photos. He had a little space in the back, which I now believe is there's a restaurant back there now. But he had a little space in the back when he worked at the bookstore. But I should say that I wrote the book about Cary, the prankster and the conspiracy, back 2003. It was published, and since then I've been the receiver of a lot more Cary Thornley materials and materials related to Discordianism and the founder of Discordianism, Greg Hill. So there's going to be a lot more projects related to Cary Thornley and the Discordian Society coming out here in the near future. And recently I was out in Atlanta at Dragon Con giving a little talk about the history of Discordianism. So that'll be one of the projects. But... Cary Thornley. I'll try to give you the thumbnail sketch.
Yeah, there's a lot, yeah.
5 or 10 minutes. He was born in Los Angeles in the late 30s, 1938. And he was a odd kid with odd interests. And somewhere along the way in high school, he met up with Greg Hill, who also had shared interests in, they were into Mad Magazine, these type of things. They also went out and they went to visit a saucer cult out there in the desert called Understanding Daniel Fry's Cult. So they had these odd interests, and somewhere along the way they discovered or created or there was a revelation where they started a religion called Discordianism, which is the worship of the Greek god of chaos and discord, Eris. So that was in the late 50s, and they had this revelation in a bowling alley of all places.
Right.
After that, so we'll shift a little bit here. Cary was in high school. There, he's in the Marine Corps Reserve. So when he got out of high school, he wanted to travel and see the world. He was a budding writer, so he figured the best way to do that was to go into the service. So he basically fulfilled his rest of his service with the Marines for the next couple of years. And his first stop there was at El Toro Marine Base, where he met none other than Lee Harvey Oswald. This was in 1959, the fall of 59, I think, if I have the timeline correct. And he and Oswald knew each other for like a three-month period, and they had a lot of in-depth conversations. I wouldn't necessarily call them close friends, but they developed a kind of rapport, and they would talk about politics and philosophy and whatnot religion. And so after that 3 month period, carried over to Shigatsugiya, Japan, and an air base there where Oswald had previously been stationed. Trip over during period, it's in the boat Idle Warriors, which was kind of about a book about the melees of the Cold Warrior during that period. How most people who got involved in the military then were really unclear about what they were doing. There was a general malaise and sense of rebellion. So Carey started writing about these different characters he knew in the Marines, and developed it into kind of made it a composite of different people he knew, and developed this character for this novel by the name of Johnny Shelburne. And so he got over to Japan and was working on this book, and during the period he was over there, Oswald defected, and at that point Oswald became the main character in this book, The Idle Warriors. So that was one of the first curiosities about Thornley, that he was writing a book about Oswald a good 3 years before the Kennedy assassination. So Carey got out of the Marines, went back to California for a while, hooked up there with Greg Hill, and they the guys were out... The story was they were at Carey's parents' place one night, and they were, you know, goofing around, making noise, and their parents wanted to shut up, so they split there, and they went over to Greg's house and got the same reception from his parents. So they said, oh, let's go out on the streets of Whittier, California, and we can't possibly bother anybody there. Sure enough, the cops pulled them over for whatever. They weren't... really clear. They picked them up on vagrancy, and they said, but we live here. And the cops said, it don't matter, you guys are making a general nuisance of yourself. So Greg and Carey talked, and they said, let's go someplace where we're not going to get hassled. And they decided the New Orleans French Quarter was the place to go. So they did. They moved there together in it was 1961, just right before Mardi Gras. So it was around February or early March of 61. Boy, I was going to try to make this a 10-minute thumbnail sketch, but
you kind of cut.
We'll just keep going here. So, okay.
Sorry.
So in New Orleans, there Thornley met. He was a budding writer, so he wanted to meet with some of the colorful characters, and met with a couple of guys there by the name of Slim Brooks and Gary Kirsten. And these guys claimed they had intelligence agency contacts and knew the mafia underground and were involved in a lot of different stuff. And so Carey started having discussions with these guys, much like he had with Oswald back in the day, religion, politics, philosophy. And out of these discussions came a theoretical discussion he had with these guys about how would you go about killing a president, and in particular John F. Kennedy. Carey at the time thought, you know, it was just kind of a morbid intellectual exercise, a theoretical discussion. But later, insert creepy work and music, sure that these words would come back to haunt him. So after a lot went on there in New Orleans, including the Kennedy assassination, when they picked up Oswald, and Thornley moved at one point to Arlington, Virginia, when they're having the Warren Commission hearings, because he thought that would be a good opportunity to him to appear before the Warren Commission, talk about Oswald, and promote this book he was working on, The Idle Warriors, based on Oswald. So all of this craziness was going on, and in 65 he actually wrote the first book on related to the Kennedy assassination, called Oswald. It was pretty slim volume and kind of took the Warren Commission approach, because that's all Curie had really been exposed to, that somehow Oswald had been influenced to be an assassin because of communist sympathies. So moving along here, Curie moved out to California, got involved, and he was involved, had his hands in all kinds of stuff. He was a libertarian. He wrote for – he was the editor of one of the first really best libertarian magazines back then. He got involved in the counterculture, dropped psychedelics, and started forming his kind of outlook in politics and religious beliefs, and fused them together with the combination of Zen Buddhism, and he's also a libertarian, anarcho-libertarian, so he came up with Zenarchy, which was later published in a book by Illuminati Press there out of Atlanta in the early 90s. So along the, during the same period, around 67, Jim Garrison began his investigation, and he fingered Curie Thornley as one of the culprits in the assassination, and actually indicted Curie Thornley. So, and even though his you don't see his character in Oliver Stone's JFK, you know, he was one of the main people that Garrison was going after during that period, which kind of screwed up Curie's mind to a certain extent, and eventually Garrison's investigation ran out of steam. Garrison claimed the CIA had been involved and other people who had undermined the whole thing. But afterwards, in the years to follow, you know, during the period Garrison was investigating Curie, Curie denied these charges that people had seen Curie with Oswald in New Orleans during the period Curie lived there, and that Oswald was one of these notorious doubles, and that Curie had written the books Idle Warriors and Oswald basically to set up Oswald before the fact to paint him as a commie sympathizer. As the mid-70s came around, Curie started, he started having memories of about what had gone on in New Orleans, and he began to suspect that he had been manipulated there. Remember the conversations he had with Slim Brooks and Gary Kirsten about assassinating the president. He believed these guys were somehow involved in the Kennedy assassination, and that he and Oswald both had carried, both Curie and Oswald had been manipulated, and perhaps MKUltra victims, mind-controlled. And as time progressed, some people suggest Curie went off the deep end and started confabulating even crazier theories that he had been a Nazi genetic breeding experiment. His parents had been spies that sold him to the Nazis, and that he and Oswald were sort of twins that were bred by this Nazi apparatus to be eventual assassins, all tied in with the Kennedy assassination. So I think I took about 5 or 10 minutes to give you a little idea of who Curie Thornley was. And I didn't really even get into Discordianism too much.
Yeah, that's absolutely no problem. Because it is an interesting topic. Do you think that he was possibly an MKUltra subject? Or do you think that that may have just been in his mind?
No, I think quite possibly he could have been. A lot of things seem to point to that. I think it's quite possible if he was, that's kind of what drove him off the deep end and had him, you know, he started confabulating a bit as he progressed over time. But it's interesting to note that there's a few things. Curie believed and later began to suspect that his CIA handler or JFK station handler there in New Orleans was the guy I mentioned by the name of Gary Kirsten, who Curie later came to suspect was E. Howard Hunt, who was a legendary CIA spook, also involved in the Watergate burglary reason the pigs hunt, it should be noted. Also spent time at Atsugi Air Base, where both Oswald and Thornley, you know, were at during that period in the late 50s, early 60s. And as it turns out, Atsugi, this was revealed years later in a piece of Rolling Stones that talked about bases where the CIA had MK Ultra operations going on, where they were dosing people with LSD, soldiers and whatnot. And one of those installations was Atsugi Air Base, where both Oswald and Thornley were. Thornley, if you look into his history, had kind of a freak out there when he was in Japan that sounds like it was a bit of an LSD freak out. And so there's a lot of other things I could bring up, incidents as well, that seems to point that perhaps naval intelligence was involved in that. Oswald, as well as Thornley, were MK Ultra victims, and that Thornley was manipulated in New Orleans. There was a lot of synchronicities, or propinquities, as Garrison called it, where Thornley seemed to be in a place, you know, at the same time that shenanigans were going on related to the Kennedy assassination. Thornley always denied it, you know, like, for instance, he went on a trip to Mexico, to Texas, during a period where Oswald had actually come to New Orleans, but there was these Oswald sightings in Texas and Mexico during the same period. So Garrison suspected that Thornley was one of these Oswald doubles. So I think Thornley could have been manipulated the same way Oswald was, you know, get him a job at the Texas School Book Depository and put him at the scene of the crime at the right time, and basically set him up to be a patsy. And Thornley suspected that they had kind of manipulated him, or they were setting up that be him to be a fallback patsy if the setup for Oswald somehow went awry.
Sure, or just one of them, because it seems interesting that these two guys meet in Japan, and then they end up in New Orleans at the same time. And Oswald is already kind of being ship dipped as a communist by that point. So that is very interesting.
Oh yeah, well Oswald was playing the role there, part of the Guy Bannister's organization.
Right. Yeah.
And if you've seen the film JFK, it goes into all
many
these
times.
Characters. Okay, so yeah, Oswald was basically posing as a communist to infiltrate commie organizations, or so he thought. While in reality is probably being set up by the likes of Bannister and Ferry and those guys.
Have you ever seen that movie, Luke?
No.
JFK?
Mm-mm. I'll have to download it.
That's a good one. Well, I have it. Anything you want to ask, Luke, before I go on?
Are you familiar with the process for mind control, or have you...
Hello.
Hey, we got cut off.
Evidently, must have said the wrong thing.
It was the CIA.
Mm-hmm. Yep, they always do that, guys.
I know. Let's cut your Skype off right in the middle of a conversation. Well, Luke, you were asking a question before we got cut off. So.
Yeah, I was just gonna see if, like, what you knew about the process of mind control, and if you could just walk me through it. You know.
Oh boy, I mean, I know what I've read from the basic mind control literature, and for instance, with the so-called Manchurian candidates or different mind control victims, what they do is the mind controller. They introduce some sort of a trauma to the victim, and as the legends go, if you believe a lot of this monarch mind control stories and whatnot, they start at a very young age and induce trauma, and the natural reactions for humans are to kind of crawl into a shell, and they'll adopt different personalities. Then these personalities later, they can be split into these programmed to be different personalities. One, you know, as a maybe as a cold-blooded killer, another to be a sex slave. So induced trauma is a big part of the programming, and you know, different as far as the MK Ultra program, they messed around with a lot of drugs. One would think that for instance LSD would be the anti mind control drug, because it totally makes you uncontrollable, but I could see LSD being used, you know, if you look at set and setting, if you're in a good set and setting, LSD can bring about some very positive results. If you intentionally take somebody down a bad trip rabbit hole, then that could cause some major trauma as well. So anyway, the CIA used a whole host of different drugs, and they never claimed they found anything that was the total drug that could control minds, but other people argue that that wasn't the case. There's a researcher by the name of John Judge who claimed that the Manson family were a basically a mind-controlled outfit, and that they were given the military brand of acid, whatever that is. He had the actual chemical name for it. I can't tell you what it is off the top of my head, and that that was the same acid that the military acid that was given to David Berkowitz, and that he was also mind controlled. So anyway, that's a partial answer to your question.
Wow. So you think that today it's more psychologically based rather than drug induced based?
Oh, I think, well, I don't know anything for sure, you know.
Right.
To tell you, but
just asking your opinion on it, you know.
Yeah, I think as well. There's the microwave harassment and that type of electronic mind control. That it's, you know, it's proven that you can beam voices into people's head, and a lot of people are recounting these experiences. I had some weird stuff happen, not voices in my head per se, but there was a few times where I was sitting in a particular place where I felt like my body temperature went just off the meter, and my face turned all red, and there were people there at the time saying, "What the heck's going on?" And this happened like half a dozen occasions, and it happened when I was sitting in one or two exact locations where somebody could have beamed something through a window. Who knows, that was during the period I was writing the Manson book, getting into a lot of this weird territory. Or it could have been, who knows, something I ate, or who can say for sure. It was pretty pretty odd, odd experience, though, and you know, that's where paranoia comes in. Is paranoia a higher form of awareness? I've like, for instance, interviewing Robert Anton Wilson and some folks that knew Carrie Thornley. It was kind of odd that anytime I talked to any of these folks, it was pretty obvious that their phones were tapped,
right?
And there's that kind of surveillance. Goes on. I'm getting away from the mind control bit, but with Robert Anton Wilson, it was pretty damn obvious for the prankster and the conspiracy. I went with my friend Greg Bishop and interviewed him there at back in, I think it was 2000, in his place in Santa Cruz, California, and we Greg taped him for me at that time. And so we get back later, and I'm working on the book, and I say, "Hey, Greg, you got that tape for me?" He said, "Yeah, I just need to edit it or do something, transfer it to cassette, and I'll get it to you in a week or two." And so a couple months pass, and I go, "Greg, what's the deal? Are you going to send me that tape?" And he said, "Yeah, I did. I sent it about a month ago." And I go, "Oh, shoot, man, I haven't seen it. I hope it didn't get lost somewhere." And so 6 months passed, at least 6 months. And one day I got the envelope, the tape from Greg of the Robert Anton Wilson interview. And it was obvious that somebody had opened it up and examined the tape and sealed it back up and sent it. But, you know, they waited several months. So there's those kind of obvious hints sometimes where, you know, folks will let you know they're monitoring your activities.
Wow.
It wouldn't shock me at all. We did a whole show a couple of months ago about the Batman shooter, the Dark Knight Returns. And it seems to me that there's a lot of, it just seems really like really that guy is pretty mind controlled to me. I don't know.
With the dimension of the second person there that the media ignored, and
yeah,
there's a lot of things that kind of point that direction from the JFK and Oklahoma City bombings.
That whole story's fallen off the radar recently, and I haven't heard anything else about it.
Yeah, and I guess he had DARPA connections. He was doing some type of research, and there was a
neuroscience.
And when they had, yeah, exactly. There was the court appearance where some strange lady in a red dress or something showed up and made some comments. Did you hear that little bit? And I haven't really looked into the case that deeply, but I plan to perhaps at some point.
That reminds me of the Sirhan Sirhan, the polka dot dress.
Yeah, that's what a lot of people brought up, and I forget, she made some cryptic comment, this gal in the courtroom, that seemed to point towards mind control or something odd going on. I forget exactly what she said, but and it was odd. I was in Colorado. I was in Boulder, Colorado, when I remember firing up the internet that morning. It was like shooting in Colorado. I go, "Oh my God, here I am in Colorado and this is going down."
Yeah,
you know, I wasn't too far. Yeah.
I wanted to talk about too that you mentioned in both of the books that I've read, the Happy Trails and the Beast of. About Jack Parsons and his association with the Babylon working and with UFOs. Just love to go into some of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad you're reading my books. That's nice to hear. that's some stuff I've been looking into for quite a while, because I've talked about my own UFO experience quite a bit that I had with a friend under the influence of certain psychedelics. And prior to that experience, we joked to ourselves, what if we saw a UFO? Nobody'd believe us. And then we started laughing our asses off. Then afterwards, we saw a bunch of UFOs and we were under the influence of psychedelics, but we were seeing the same things and recounting them to each other, and the experience, it seemed almost to the point where we were interacting with some type of energy. We were helped creating the experience. And as I look back on it over the years, I began to suspect that we planted a seed by saying, you know, what if we saw some UFOs? Then we saw the UFOs. It was like an unwitting magic ritual. And all that kind of got me interested. I think Robert Anton Wilson initially turned me on to Crowley and his Lom encounters around the turn of the century, century before this century, where
it looks like a little gray alien.
Yeah, and how it looked, a lot like the critter on Whitley Strieber's Communion.
Yes.
And that he had used these Enochian rituals to summon this entity. And so Jack Parsons comes along, and Jack Parsons was a famous rocket scientist, really not famous in the world of aeronautics, aviation. I have a lot of people who are like real rocket scientists. I know a couple people, and you bring up the name Jack Parsons, he's kind of lost that they don't know him, or they pretend not to. I don't know what the deal is, but he came up with the solid-fueled rockets, one of the inventors that, you know, was later the propulsion system that jettisoned man to the moon. And helped found the Jet Propulsion Laboratories in Los Angeles. and so he was also a ritual magician. And basically he became Aleister Crowley's ambassador here in the States. This was during the late 40s, 50s that Parsons was active, and he started doing his own magical rituals along with none other than L. Ron Hubbard, the future founder of Scientology, and his future wife, Cameron Parsons. And they invoked certain entities, as the story goes. There's different stories you hear out there, but they invoked some otherworldly entities out in the California desert, which later became the hotbed in the early days of UFOs. And certain theorists have suggested that Parsons and Hubbard and Cameron were able to open the same portal that Aleister Crowley opened that brought in Lom, and they basically, Parsons and his bunch, ushered in the new era of the new age of UFOs, or the modern age of UFOs as they're called. Their rivals, Parsons and Hubbard and Cameron, happened in 1946, and the modern age of UFOs started in 47 with Kenneth Arnold's sightings over Mount Rainier in Washington State. That's where the term flying saucers came from, and also Roswell. Whatever happened there happened in 47, and that seemed to launch the whole phenomenon. So that's kind of where my initial interest in all of this started, and I've did different presentations at UFO conferences on this theme with a lecture I had called the Early UFO Contactees, Ritual Magicians. And when I looked at those early UFO contactees, it seemed to be a common theme. A lot of times before they had these experiences, they went into trance states by whatever means. So, like, that was the way of invoking these entities, whatever they are. Who's to say they're extraterrestrial? People like to throw around terms interdimensional or the crypto-terrestrials. Maybe they actually live here on Earth and are all around us, but we only can see them when we tap into a certain mind frame, a certain realm of consciousness that can open up those windows, much like the experience I think that I had under the influence of psychedelics, that I was able to tap into that and peek behind the veil for however short a period it was.
So you would feel that kind of like the jury is still out on what exactly that phenomenon is, that it may be some kind of like more like an ultra-terrestrial kind of thing?
Mm-hmm. You know, that's the theory that makes the most sense to me, and that we're involved in that process. The experiencer is part of the experience, I think, as well. Not to discount the other theories that, you know, I don't discount that actual ETs have been here, or there's all kinds of theories out there. That's the one that makes the most sense to me, though.
Yeah, I have to agree with you there. Assuming that aliens would be on a higher state of consciousness, it only makes sense that you would have to be closer to the same level to be able to experience them.
Yeah, and people, there's all kinds of stories, you know, I was talking about ritual magic and trance states, but also people who've taken psychedelics and seen things. You're probably aware of Terrence McKenna, and comedian Bill Hicks had some pretty profound experiences on mushrooms. The list goes on and on. Timothy Leary, you know, it's interesting that Robert Anton Wilson, Timothy Leary, Philip K. Dick were all having these, and John Lilly too, all around the same period, and they had all experimented with hallucinogens of one kind or another, and during that same period, 72, 73, were all having experiences with the other, who they perceived initially, you know, to be extraterrestrials.
I believe it was John Lilly that was the one that his experiences were the basis for Altered States.
That's correct. Yeah.
That was an extremely interesting story for me because I had no idea that, you know, I'd seen Altered States for a long time, seen it many times, and I had no idea that that was actually based on a true story. Could you kind of go into about what that was about? It's kind of similar to the Philip K. Dick story as well.
Well, I'd say first of all about the movie Altered States. It's been a while since I saw it, but it was the character there. Did he go into an isolation tank and then he came out and
He had a couple of different kinds. He had the vertical, like liquid isolation. Well, they're all liquid, but the vertical one first, and then he got into the closed no window one.
Yeah.
Second time.
Just as an aside, Luke's brother, who we've had on this show, has done a lot of
those kind of stuff. Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He kind of frightened himself to a point of, you know, maybe I'm taking this on a little bit too fast. Maybe I should slow down, you know?
Yeah, I did ice the flotation tanks, actually, what it's, I guess, referred to, and a pretty profound experience. I got a lot out of it. You guys still with me there?
Oh, yeah, we're here. Yeah.
Okay. The film, he turns into some type of ape man or something, running him up. And that was kind of based on Lily's partner, who had an experience where he perceived himself going back in time. And, you know, it was one of those self-realization type thing, seeing the history of mankind and him going back into an ape. So they took that from the movie and ran with it. But with Lily's encounters, you know, it's much like I said, Leary and all these guys back then, Robert Anton Wilson, around the same period, they started having communications with who they perceived to be extraterrestrials. Lily brought about his experience by the use of ketamine, the drug ketamine. And I've written about this a bit, I think, in the Beast of Adam, Go Rightly. And he thought, you know, during one time that Earth had hit in a critical juncture and that we needed to, he was trying to contact politicians and all this, that ecological doom was at hand, and his message, Lily's at that time, was much like the UFO contactees from back in the 50s and 60s during the Cold War period. That's the message, same messages they were getting from the extraterrestrials. So, yeah, Lily was among a bunch of psychedelicized folks who were having these extraterrestrial communications during that period.
And Philip K. Dick also. I know that what was it that he had thought that he was in communication with a giant computer or some kind of software or something that was beaming to him?
Well, it took different forms, but at one time or another, and in his book Valis, he says star system behind that was the Sirius star system and the entities from Sirius. At the same time he was receiving his communications, Robert Anton Wilson was delving into Enochian magic, you know, much like Parsons and Crowley had, and at one point came into contact with what he believed at that time were beings from the Sirius star system. Later, Wilson stepped back and thought, oh, well, it could have been my left brain talking to my right brain or this or that. But that was the uniqueness there, that they both Dick and Wilson were having these Sirius communications at the same time, unbeknownst to each other. There was also a science fiction author, Doris Lessing, who was also kind of channeling books about Sirius at the same time. At the exact same time, Timothy Leary wrote his, he was in prison, and he'd become part of a group that were doing meditations and basically using, group of inmates, they had this pent-up sexual energy from, you know, not having contact with their wife, their lovers, spouses, whatnot, and they were using this as a meditation group, and through this meditation group, they started receiving channeled messages, and Leary wrote about that, recorded these messages in a book called Starseed Transmissions. This was the same period where he and Wilson were doing a lot of work together, but when Leary started telling Robert Anton Wilson about this, Wilson kind of held back because he didn't want to interject his serious stuff in there. He wanted to kind of see where the information went, but and not kind of influence Leary, or vice versa. So it was interesting. All this energy was going on. I think even you'd have to look at the timeline. Terrence McKenna and the stuff he was doing with his brother with ayahuasca and shrooms was probably in the early 70s too. So there's a lot of strange energies out there during that period. I looked, one thing I did when I was researching all of this, I found a website that had peaks of UFO encounters, peak years, and you know, over a 50-year period, there was like half a dozen peaks, and one of those peaks was that period of time, 1972-73. Another peak was when I had my own psychedelic UFO encounter in 1978. Some of the other peaks were, you guessed it, like 46 and 47, when you had that Parsons and Hubbard and the Modern Age of UFOs, and also 1952 when a lot of the UFO contactees like George Adamski had their experiences. So I think there's different things going on. It has to do with peak energy years and being in a certain spot. A lot of the contacts came in places like the California desert. And you guys still there?
Yeah, we're here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're here.
And kind of rambling all over the place, but
no problem.
Yeah.
We're just listening, taking it all in.
Yep. So anyway,
what is Enochian magic? I'm maybe Luke, you might know a little more than I do, but what is that?
Oh heck! Well, it was something that was developed by an Elizabethan magician, Dr. John Dee, back in the day. And it's derived somehow from the Bible. There was the Book of Enoch.
Right.
And that was related to these, Book of Enoch, related to these fallen angels that came to Earth and bed down the Earth women, and they brought about this race called the Nephilim. And so it's kind of all related to that. A lot of people equate the Nephilim with modern-day ETs. And this is just my take on all this. And so it kind of came out of that and Dr. John Dee developed it, and somehow Crowley picked up on it, and whether it was, Crowley came up with his own twist on it, who knows, but that's what Crowley used to bring forth Lom, we talked about before. And there was other people like, there was a guy named George Hunt Williamson who was friends with George Adamski. And he was messing around with Enochian magic in 52 or so. And through that, he basically invoked beings from the star system Sirius. So when you start digging into this stuff, you see all these connections that go on and on. Sometimes you think, well, is that perhaps a meme that got started somehow, and it's somehow in our subconscious?
It also features its own language, much like the language of the Magi, and used, like, you know, ritualistically to invoke. Isn't it supposed to be a lost book of the Bible as well?
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So I've heard, yeah.
And the Gnostics had a hand in it somehow?
I think it might be older than that, actually.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and you guys are friends with Guy Malone, right?
Yeah, we know him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's he was... let's see, what he was kind of a bit of an influence, and I think I was an influence on him. We have different takes, and I'm trying to remember specific... I'd have to look at my... anyway, disregard that.
We had him on the show a few months ago.
Yeah.
So
you can clip that out. I forgot. had a brain fade there.
No problem. We're a very conversational show, so.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed I was looking through here, one thing that I had kind of forgotten about from reading the book, The Happy Trails, was that you got to sit in on the Bigfoot reveal, the one that turned out to be a hoax.
That
been an experience.
It was indeed interesting. I got the email one day. There was a press release that came out saying they had somebody had a Bigfoot body or something. I'm not that heavily involved with the Bigfoot scene, but they're putting on a press conference near San Jose, California, which isn't too bloody far from where I'm at. So I was able to finagle a press pass, so I thought, oh, I'll go check this out. Maybe I'll be part of history. And so I showed up there, and it was a huge event. It probably set back Bigfootology and cryptozoology 20 years, you know. Anytime now somebody says they have a Bigfoot or something, they'll go, oh, yeah, I remember that hoax back in 2000 and whenever it was. It's probably about... 4 or 5 years ago now.
Yeah, it was 2008.
Yeah, lose track of time. But so I went and showed up, and they had the press was there big time. You had CNN and all the major networks from the local area were there, and you had a phalanx of about 20 cameras, and they were doing a live. I think they did a live feed from CNN. It was a packed house.
Circus.
And the circus, this even got stranger and stranger, of course. No, they didn't have the body. They had it secured away somewhere. And Tom Biscardi was the ringmaster there overseeing things, who I've learned has a history in Las Vegas promoting things. And this wasn't his first Bigfoot hoax, as I found out.
Right.
Later, but they said they brought some DNA samples of the Bigfoot, and he also had some of the funky photos. It was like, okay, then he had his the two guys, hucksters from wherever they were. I forget if it was
Georgia.
Mm-hmm. And they showed up, and he was trumpeting their praises, how these guys are, you know, these guys are the real deal, blah, blah, blah. Well, anyway, as we know, all this didn't last very long. The DNA samples didn't really prove much of anything. I don't know how you prove with the DNA sample anyway, since we don't have a Bigfoot DNA sample, but the sample
to compare it to.
Yeah, but the sample had traces of possum in it, and these guys claim that, or Biscardi did, that was because Bigfoot had ate a possum and it was in his intestinal tract. And so, anyway, it was crazy. And, of course, later it turned out that... Oh, and Biscardi at the press conference said, "Folks, this is the real deal. I touched it, prodded it, smelled it. I seen the body. This is the real deal," on and on. As it turned out later that, you know, those guys from Georgia had got a fake Bigfoot body and stuffed it full with roadkill and whatnot, and that's... But Biscardi later said, well, no, it was his assistants that went there and saw it. And
he tried to cut. I think he left the country right after that happened.
No, he's back here. He's still doing Bigfoot stuff, you know. Yeah. So he should have drove a stake through his heart. The other two guys, one of them was a worked on the police force there in Georgia somewhere, and he shortly after that lost his job due to this whole affair.
Yeah, he didn't stick around too long over there. Speaking of Georgia, that that jogged my memory. I saw that you had gone to Dragon Con and that you visited the Georgia Guidestones. And yeah. We actually, our picture on the if you've seen the podcast website, our picture there is actually Luke looking through one of the astronomical alignment holes.
Ah, yeah.
So, what are your thoughts on the Georgia Guidestone? Like, what do you think that they're supposed to be? What they they signify?
Well, the guy I went with, he goes on Facebook by the name of Groucho Gandhi, and he's actually the publisher at Fiji Press, who published Happy Trails to High Weirdness, and he's been an aficionado of the Guidestones for many years. He used to go back there way back when, you know, 20 years ago or so before it became as popular as it seems to be now. When we went out there, and he's actually written about it. If you go to GrouchoGandhi.com, he has a piece on the Georgia Guidestones. He wrote a few years ago. It was kind of I was kind of aware of the Guidestones. I knew it was something I had to check out. And so he during the Dragon Con thing, I said, "Hey, I want to go check out the Guidestones as well." While I was out there in Atlanta, so he took me to wherever the heck that is out there in
Elberton, Alberta. Georgia. Yeah.
There you go. That's the name of the town.
You guys, capital of the South.
You guys, yeah. They got it from the granite quarry there, and there's the whole mythology about this R.C. Christian, the mysterious guy who left, basically set up a trust fund and funded this. There was a mysterious group out of state, R.C. Christian, which is kind of like a hint towards Rosicrucianism.
Yes.
He got this banker who basically built this thing. It was over like a 10-year period, wasn't it? The stones?
I believe so. I'm not quite sure.
Several.
I know it was erected in 1980, at least.
They took several years, and those are some big, heavy-ass stones and intricate work detailed on the carving, and they have the astronomical features, which you see in a lot of ancient ruins, and the message there. It's like a New World Order, feel-good message about, except for the part that talks about reducing the population, so there's sinister aspect to it as well. Pretty unique and interesting sight. Also, while we were out there, I contacted the widow, actually, of Ron Bonds of Illuminate Press. I'd been in contact with her for a bunch of years. And Illuminate Press published Carrie Thornley's books. And I remember years ago after Ron Bonds died, kind of a mysterious death. He died around the same year or so after Thornley and his buddy Jim Keith, who he published a bunch of his books. Jim Keith died mysteriously during that same period. You might be familiar with Jim Keith's books. They were published by Illuminate, Black Helicopters Over America and Men in Black books. He was really one of the main dudes on the conspiracy scene late 90s or so, and I had contacted Ron's wife, Nancy, because I knew she had some Carrie Thornley materials and wanted to try to perhaps purchase those from her or something. It was the time I was writing my book. And, of course, she was going through a lot of stuff, you know, during that period. Her husband had just died, so communication fell off. But I thought since I was going out to Atlanta, I'd contact her, and she got back to me, and I said had a couple things, questions I needed to ask her. But I asked her about those Carrie Thornley materials, and she said, you can have them as far as I'm concerned, you know, let's get together over coffee. And we did, and I met up with her, and it was a great meeting, and she passed on to me more Carrie Thornley material. I've also been the recipient of the archives of Greg Hill, who was the founder of Discordianism. So, as I was mentioning before, I have tons of material that's probably going to lead to several books here in the next few years. About one I'm working on now is more detailed about Carrie Thornley and the Kennedy assassination, but there'll be a history of the Discordian Society and a few other things, facsimiles of like the first edition of the Principia Discordia, which was the Bible of Discordianism. So anyway, that's my travels in Atlanta, in Georgia, and some of the projects I'm involved in now.
So would you say that you're kind of the heir to all the Discordian knowledge? Because you were also really good friends with Robert Anton Wilson, and now you have all the material from the originators of it.
Yeah, well. And I am. That's a correct assessment. And I just kind of stumbled into this stuff. If you read my book, The Prankster and the Conspiracy, I didn't really know that much about Discordianism when I started that. I was more interested in Carrie Thornley's story, so I was kind of gathering materials and thinking about writing a book. Then in 2000, I got an email from this guy named Bob Newport, and it was odd because the email I received, it was at an email address where nobody would really know to contact me there except family and maybe a few friends, nobody involved with my alter ego, you know, writing conspiracy work. So it was odd. I got an email there alerting me from a fellow named Bob Newport, alerting me of Greg Hill's passing. And I think it was July of 2000. Greg Hill, of course, Thornley, was the founder of Discordianism. So I thought, well, that's weird. I emailed Newport back and said, did you happen to know Carrie Thornley as well? He said, yeah, I went to high school with both of them, and actually I'm the co-founder of Discordianism. Now, there's no way that I can figure out how he had that email address. Years later, when I talked to Newport about this, I'd ask him, well, how did you know to email me there? And it's like he didn't really remember at all. And so it was by fate, dumb luck, or the powers of the goddess Eris that that initial contact came with Newport, and that opened up, you know, having interviews with meeting Bob Wilson and all the other Discordian folks. And as it turned out, Newport had basically rescued Greg Hill's Discordian archives from being dumped into a dumpster. And he had plans maybe to do something with him at one point, but he's getting older and he's more into, you know, he's thinking of doing some type of Discordian archives website, but he doesn't have the time. He's more into water painting these days with watercolors, and he said eventually handing them off to me, and that it's just an enormous amount of materials that I'm trying to wrap my head around. Like I said, it will be result to a number of projects which are going to blow the minds of people who are interested in the origins and the early days of the Discordian Society.
Very interesting. Very cool. Adam, we are just about out of time, and we didn't even get to talk about the Manson family.
Yeah. Oh, darn.
we need to have you on for another show, maybe sometime in the next few months, just to talk about just the Manson family.
Yeah, and also Burning Man.
Yeah, Burning Man.
Sure.
Jim Keith, too, because we barely touched on that, and how his him writing about Danny Casolaro and the Octopus Conspiracy, and there's just so much to talk about that, like, even an hour or 15 hours wouldn't even do it justice.
Yeah, I hear you.
But we're going to finish out here. Just Adam, just stay on the line with us, and we'll, Luke, we're going to be right back on Conspiranormal. All right, we are back on Conspiranormal. Luke, just briefly, man, what'd you think about Adam Gorightly?
I think he's pretty awesome, and yeah, he's pretty awesome.
Man, you are a man of many words.
he's got this kind of California like beach guy type thing going on. Like, dude, you know.
Yeah.
I like him. You know, he'd be someone that would be my friend. So
we'd have to go out for a beer with the guy if he ever comes by here.
Definitely. Definitely.
Just so many things that we just even get to talk about. Like, we didn't even hit the Manson stuff, which is like a big thing that he talks about.
Right.
And how that's, he did touch on it a little briefly, but I'm glad you asked about the mind control stuff.
Yeah.
Because that's another thing that he talks about.
Right. You know, me and you are talking about that at one point, and how it's done and everything. And I just wanted to see, like, what if he knew something that we didn't, or.
He writes about The Catcher in the Rye, the book being like a trigger, like I was talking about a few shows ago. And I mean, it's just very interesting stuff, and all the connections. What he brought up tonight about like the UFO flaps and everybody doing drugs happening at the same time.
That was
quite interesting. I never quite thought of it that way.
I'm kind of taking a shift more toward ethereal aliens versus like physical, whereas before I was thinking, you know, that they came here on some kind of organic ship, you know, but now I'm starting to think that the ship is themselves, and they're personally teleporting here.
Yeah.
More of like a spiritual / etheric thing rather than being physical.
Well, I found it interesting about the Enochian magic, too.
Yeah, I heard a little bit about that from my brother, because he used to be really... Yeah. He still is in Aleister Crowley and all of his work and stuff.
They actually talk about that in the show Supernatural, to use Enochian magic to summon and banish angels.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where I'm... And Dr. John Dee, where I'm a little familiar, semi-familiar with that, you know.
And like he implied too, like it's a later language. It's not something that's ancient, like found on ancient carvings and stuff.
Yeah.
It's something made way later. But the language of the Magi, however, had been, and that's what Enochian's kind of based off of. That,
sure.
Along with like two or three other languages, it's in Aleister Crowley's collaboration of symbols and stuff, like that, and explaining symbology and all that.
Well, the lamb thing. You've seen a picture of lamb. I've shown you that before. Looks very much like a little gray alien.
Yeah.
And this was something that he said that he saw in the Great Pyramid in like 1895 that was communicating to him. Crowley's a little weird. I don't really, you know, like Crowley too much, but
I do. I think it's awesome.
You and Jimmy Page both, man. But I think we're gonna call it, because don't want to go too long, because Chris is gonna kill us. He's about to pass out. So. let's call it a night, man. Anything you want to add or say before we go, Chief Keefe?
I thought about like having an ending segment with like some words of inspiration or something. That'd be nice.
Well, you can give the words of inspiration.
Not this time. I ain't ready for
it. Well, you did get some good news while we were on the talking to Adam Garightly, but yeah. we won't go into that.
Why not? Go ahead.
No. Just everybody just feel happy for Luke. He gets to party
slow
a little.
Clap.
He gets to party a little more.
Luke's not a daddy.
All right. Yeah, Luke's not a daddy. All right, so that's it, and just come back and join us next time on Conspiranormal.
Don't do drugs. We'll be right back.